From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The architecture of our cities and communities often reflects the current social order, but it can also, unfortunately, preserve injustice. So many American cities are racially segregated, with their geography reflecting prejudices. One man who has written an exceptional memoir of his exploration of architecture and racism is Carl Anthony. In his new book, The Earth, the City, and the Hidden Narrative of Race, Anthony tells his own story of being one of the few Black architectural students as he came of age during the Civil Rights Movement, then traveled to West Africa, explored the history of cities, and formed new approaches to inclusive spaces that foster racial and environmental justice. Carl Anthony is, in addition to being an architect, a regional planner and social justice leader, co-founder of the Breakthrough Communities Project, and visiting professor at the UC Davis Center for Regional Change. He's revered as the founder and former executive director of Urban Habitat, one of the nation's oldest environmental justice organizations, known for pushing the mainstream environmental movement to confront issues of race and class. He now joins me to discuss his new book. Again, it's called The Earth, the City, and the Hidden Narrative of Race. It's such an honor to have you on the program, Mr. Anthony.
It's an honor to be here.
So let's start at the beginning. In your book, you talk about where you grew up in Philadelphia, in a part of Philadelphia that's called Philadelphia's Black Bottom. Tell us a little bit about that part of the city and the time that you grew up, how that influenced who you became.
Well, the bottom is an area of Philadelphia, but many cities across the country have a bottom, which is really refers to the relationship to sea level rise. And it turns out that the bottom is a place that very often poor people and African American people have been forced to live. So I was born in a place in Philadelphia called the Black Bottom, but there's also bottoms in Washington, D.C., in Detroit, in New Orleans, it's called the Ninth Ward, and in Oakland, California, and many other places, there are these communities are located where there's actually been flooding whenever there's a heavy rain, and especially when the sea level rises. So I had that experience growing up, and I didn't know it was called the bottom until I actually grew up and went to school and met a professor who specialized in telling the stories of people who grew up in West Philadelphia.
So how did you come to the conclusion that you wanted to become an architect? What were the influences in your early part of your life that led you to the Columbia University School of Architecture?
Well, you know, the times that people, young people, make a commitment to a professional direction are mysterious. The process is really mysterious. I had a third grade teacher who was absolutely wonderful, and she gave us, our class, an exposure to a wide variety of issues, including issues of how the earth came into being and issues of the trees that were in Philadelphia and birds, and we had to know all of the names of the trees and identify them by bark. But we also, she was very instrumental in taking me and our class to an exhibition in 1947 called the Greater Philadelphia Exposition. And it was an event that actually featured the thinking of the leading architects and planners of the day about how the city would grow in 25 years. And I was really impressed with this exhibition. And it had photographs, it had motion pictures, it had drawings and so forth. And I was really pleased to be able to, and it had a huge model of Philadelphia, where you could look at the way it was laid out when we were visiting it, and then you could actually manipulated so you could see how the city would grow in 25 years. And that was the moment that I decided that I wanted to be an architect.
And at the Columbia University School of Architecture, you discovered you were, what, the only Black student in architecture at the time?
Well, I think there might have been a student in another class, but I was basically the only one or two of us were actually the only students in the whole architecture school. There were about 300 students, and there might have been two, I think, that were.
And what did you learn during your time there that made you sort of, or helped you understand the role that architecture plays in how our societies are organized and sort of reinforce the existing racial injustices that divide us?
Well, I think my introduction to issues of racism came in part because I was actually searching for some way to understand my own situation and my own position in the making of buildings and the relationship between buildings and African-American culture. And of course, there was nothing in the school curriculum or the teaching that helped to orient us. So I had to go searching over my whole education to see what I could find. And eventually, I kind of gave up on that exercise. And when the rest of my class got a fellowship to travel to Europe, I had the same fellowship, but I took made a trip to Africa to really learn about the traditional villages in Africa and learned a very great deal that was never exposed to in any formal studies.
Was your trip to Africa also part of your sort of journey to getting an understanding of your own belonging? You talk in your book a lot about the search for a sense of belonging.
Well, you know, it was actually an incremental process. I went to Africa and I was astounded by visiting. I spent more than a year traveling with a Volkswagen bus and my former partner. We traveled across the base of the desert from Dakar through Senegal and Mali, and it was called Upper Volta then, to Niger and Nigeria, and then we traveled down through Nigeria and across the western coast of Africa to Ghana. And during that time, we had exposure to a wide variety of traditional ways in which people approach building. And these experiences were quite remarkable to me, because I had not seen anything like that in my formal education as an architect.
And so at the time in the United States, of course, we had tremendous racial segregation within our cities. And to an extent, much of that exists today, unfortunately, or we find our cities becoming resegregated. How did you take what you learned and some of the things that you discovered in your travels in West Africa and start to think about American cities and how American cities are organized?
Well, miraculously, and it was actually kind of a surprise to me, I visited these traditional buildings which had not really been influenced much by Western development, and I was actually taken by them. I really was very enthusiastic, and these buildings were extremely modest in terms of the amount of money that was required to build them. The materials that were used were built materials that came directly from the from the surroundings, including mud and thatch that was traditional building materials. And I noticed as I was traveling through the country that they were also very responsive to the environment. It showed a respect for the desert environment and responsive to the differences in the climate of each place, including the development of buildings in the rainforest. But what was really remarkable to me, and I didn't really quite know what to do with it, was that the first European buildings built in the 15th century along the coast of Africa were actually originally were buildings that were designed for the exploitation of the gold mining in Africa, but eventually became slave trading castles all along the coast of Africa. And I had a kind of a shock when I realized that actually this tradition of building these castles was very much part of European cultural domination of the world. And so I had kind of a shift in my consciousness. And I felt the really important thing is to understand how these developments had an effect on settlement of Europeans and Africans in the New World that were basically places where the indigenous population lived.
You also write in your book about the other influences that you had, aside from the university you went to, the travels you did. You discovered through books, through authors, a whole new world and ways of thinking about architecture, ways of thinking about race and racism. And you write about first discovering James Baldwin and Lewis Mumford. Tell us a little bit about these other influences through the world of books. And of course, you went on to then meet James Baldwin and host him personally.
Well, Lewis Mumford was, as you may know, was the architectural critic at the New Yorker magazine. He wrote a column which appeared every week about American development. And I first came across him when I was working in a library in Philadelphia. And one of his books happened to be on the shelf, happened to be on the cart that I was putting back to the shelf, and it was called The Condition of Man. And when I read this, I was taken aback because not only was it a book about architecture and building, it was also how different societies really responded to the opportunities and the challenges of building. And I became very fascinated with the idea of exploring how the experience of Africans and African Americans could really be interpreted in that larger sense. And I was particularly influenced by a book called Sticks and Stones, which traced the early European experience coming to the New World and how people had brought their traditions to the New World. And I wanted to find a way to interpret the experience of Africans and African Americans. And as I progressed through my education, I found there was no really important resources available in my normal curriculum. But I did find other examples. For example, at the Museum of Modern Art, there was an exhibition called Architecture Without Architects. And there were amazing traditions of people all over the world that had been really developed without the assistance of architects. And this was fascinating to me. And then there was another book called The Lost Cities of Africa by Basil Davidson, which traced, described the efforts of people, the explorers, to really understand what traditional African buildings had been like and how they related to the society. And so piece by piece, I kind of put together the story of thousands of years of African experience. And then I raised a question. I was trying to make sense out of my own description of African buildings. And I realized that if I don't understand myself and who I am and how that related to the forces of the creation of the modern world, that I would not be able to really describe this and make it really interesting for the reader. And so at that point, I began to realize I had to come to terms with the history of slavery, which had been really whited out, made invisible in our traditional discussion of architecture.
And so at the same time, the civil rights movement was playing out here in the United States. You write about seeing Malcolm X and in Harlem. So how did those two parts of your life collide? The discovery of African architecture and then seeing the civil rights movement in the U.S.?
Well, as I say, it was really kind of an amazing experience because this was the early 1960s, and I came in contact with the young people who had started the sit-in movement in the South. And we would have these discussions going into the night, which I thought were really remarkable And then the next day, I would look at the New York Times on the front page, and I would see descriptions of the work that the people, young people, were doing in the South. And there was an amazing juxtaposition between my having that firsthand experience with those people and then and seeing it in the newspaper. And then I made friendships with them and went to a conference at Sarah Lawrence College, where I met many of them. And that kind of launched my experience in the civil rights movement in the U.S.
Eventually, you moved on to the West Coast, and you went to the University of California at Berkeley's School of Environmental Design. How did you start to apply all of synthesize all of the influences and your newly forming ideologies at UC Berkeley and your own life experiences?
Well, my experience at UC Berkeley was also remarkable in its own right. At the time that I moved there in the early, after I had come back from Africa and got a job as an assistant professor, I moved into a department that had a very strong reputation for having social factors. Studying the ways in which social factors really affected the design of buildings, and many of the people who were teaching at that time were remarkable professors. And so I came to that school, and I was really kind of challenged to bring a new perspectives that I had really uncovered in my early career growing up and going to school at Columbia University, and also traveling to Africa. So it was a remarkable period. And as you may remember, I don't really know what your experience has been, but in the late 60s, there were really major upheavals going on in the universities around the country. And this was also kind of filling my experience at that time. And I decided that it was really important for me to play a role in trying to get more African and Latino students into the schools and also on the faculty. And that absorbed a great deal of my early attention while I was collaborating with these amazing professors and learning about the most advanced innovations going on in the field.
Right, because a big part of the problem was that the academy itself wasn't diverse enough to bring different viewpoints so that people could start thinking differently about
absolutely
how our cities are organized.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you write in your book about how you were among the early adopters of the community design movement, a social movement that sought to link architecture and urban and community planning with civil rights. What is the community design movement?
Well, this is a movement in architecture that it built on a very long tradition, but it found expression in the 1960s through another person that I had met who was teaching landscape architecture at the University of Pennsylvania. His name was Carl Lynn, and he was one of the early adopters of participatory design, where the people from communities had a say in how buildings were designed and what the needs of the community were and how they would be reflected in buildings. So, and then there was another man named Paul Davidoff who wrote an astounding essay on pluralism in architecture, the advocacy movement, and that helped to shape our thinking about buildings in the late 1960s.
And it's amazing because today more and more city planners are thinking in these ways. The idea of actually designing a city and planning architecture around the needs of the community has become something we end up taking for granted as being an obvious fact, but it didn't used to be. So let's also now talk a little bit about this idea of environmental racism, because you spoke earlier when we started our conversation about Philadelphia's Black Bottom, areas in cities that often would get flooded, where the least desirable parts of the city is where communities of color, in particular African-American communities, were relegated to. And the movement for environmental justice has for decades been identifying this idea of environmental racism. How can architects, and how have architects and city planners begun to address environmental racism in ways that that they can actually control in terms of reorganizing cities and understanding the climate crisis?
Well, I think the ways in which communities adapt to their surroundings really has been visible, but not very visible for a long time. And in the 1980s, there was a spontaneous explosion all across the country when people understood the connection between toxic waste and racism. You know, the United Church of Christ had a commission on racial justice, and they published a report that really identified the hazardous waste facilities across the country. And we found, remarkably, that the most reliable predictor of where hazardous waste facilities would be located was in neighborhoods of people of color, that it was a more reliable indicator than the education of those communities or the home ownership of those communities or any other indicator that would really predict where the hazardous waste would be located. And so the United Church of Christ carried out a series of public hearings across the country in communities that had been impacted by these experiences. And it became kind of a spontaneous outpouring to really address the problem of toxics in communities of color. We had a conference in Washington, D.C. in October of 1991, which became the founding of the environmental justice movement.
And you are now the co-founder of the Breakthrough Communities Project. Is that the sort of culmination of some of this work that you've been doing on environmental justice and addressing environmental racism?
Yes. What happened is I started a program in San Francisco called the Urban Habitat Program, and that program was a part of Earth Island Institute, and I eventually became president of this worldwide environmental organization. And our efforts to create a new kind of program that addressed the needs of communities of color took form, and we published a report or a journal called the Race, Poverty, and Environment Journal. And in this journal, we began to document how almost every single environmental issue was also a social and racial justice issue. So whether it was food or energy or population or any of a number of issues, we found that they all had a common denominator that people of color could readily understand from our own personal experience. And so we published these findings in our report. We put out two or three editions per year for 10 years that I was there. And it really provided a kind of foundation for understanding how race and poverty was reflected in the environmental conditions of our communities across the country.
And of course, today, so many of the ideas of planning and this sort of planning is applicable to all communities when we want to think about sustainability, right? I mean, we don't just want communities of color to be sustainable. We want all communities to be sustainable because we share an atmosphere and we all pay the price when our atmosphere acts and our climate acts in unpredictable ways. How much of the lessons from the movement that you've been a part of are being applied or being learned and applied universally, or are we still a long way to go?
Oh, we have a long way to go. but really miraculously, when we started the environmental justice movement, and I was among the first people who were involved in this, and there were several other places across the country. The West Harlem Environmental Action Group was established in those days, and Bob Bullard was down at, in Atlanta at the Environmental Justice Committee. The Southwest Network had been established on the West Coast addressing these issues. And what really basically happened is that we spontaneously began to understand some of the lessons that could be applied. And we found that although most of the issues had been focused on toxics at that time, there were actually a range of environmental lessons that could be applied across the board, not only at the most vulnerable communities, but also the ways in which all communities were really being planned. So we learned from that experience, and we had the wonderful opportunity to be invited by the Ford Foundation to set up what was called the Sustainable Metropolitan Communities Initiative. And we then were able to study the and participate in the work of all communities in beginning to kind of shape the environment in such a way that not only were environmental issues and economic development issues, but also the social issues of racial and social dislocation were actually taken seriously. Hmm. And when I came back from the Ford Foundation, I left there in 2008, we had the remarkable experience of working in the Bay Area, an area of about 7 million people and 100 jurisdictions. We began to respond to the issues of climate justice and climate change by developing solutions that would reflect the needs of communities in the process of trying to plan for mitigation of climate effects and the long-term adaptation to communities to the world in which climate change was really becoming an increasingly important factor.
Finally, the name of your book is The Earth, the City, and the Hidden Narrative of Race. The first part of that title, The Earth, I want to end with that, with a note on that. You talk in your book about the sort of about finding one's place and getting a sense of belonging, and you write a lot about sort of cosmology as well. Can you end with a few thoughts on finding your place in the cosmos?
Well, I thank you very much for that. We found some really great resources to use as a foundation for our study and work, and one of those resources was The Universe Story, which was published by several really amazing authors, and including Thomas Berry and Brian Swim and Mary Evelyn Tucker at Yale University. And we found that looking at the early evolution of humanity in the planet really gave us some insights into how to think about and how to design and build our cities, and we put together some of the most profound experiences that we've had over a lifetime. But in particular, we were able to adapt to the new emerging interest in climate change and begin to mobilize communities to organize around really an expression of their own needs. And what was really remarkable in this experience was that our communities came together around issues like investment without displacement, making a transportation system just, really addressing the needs of economic health and viability of our neighborhoods and communities. We found ways to really incorporate many of these situations in the design of new communities that we could see the beginning of how to really think about making our cities more responsive to the needs of communities of color and low-income communities and other disadvantaged communities across the country.
Well, I want to thank you so much for spending this time with us. It's been a real honor to have you on our program, and thanks for all the work you've done over the years.
Thank you very much.
Carl Anthony is an architect, regional planner, and social justice leader, co-founder of Breakthrough Communities Project, visiting professor at UC Davis Center for Regional Change. We've been discussing his new book, The Earth, the City, and the Hidden Narrative of Race. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.